Thank you for downloading this program. In this edition, we're looking at the art of paying less tax, the tax avoidance schemes commonly used by some of the big multinational companies. Hello and welcome to the program. And pull up a chair, stop what you're doing. This one might get complicated because we're going to tackle that most thorny issue of corporate tax today. Now, there is a pervasive sense that the system has gone off the rails, with big multinationals essentially paying tax voluntarily. Is that true? How do they get away with it? And whose fault is it anyway? We'll drill down into some details, and we'll also ask some very basic questions about what corporation tax is for. And to help us, three of the best tax advisors money can buy, and they're kindly donating their expertise to us. So let's meet them. And first up is Heather Self, a partner at the international law firm Pinsent Masons. And you're not actually a lawyer, Heather. What are you?
I'm a chartered accountant and chartered tax advisor.
Right. So the law firm hires some accountants to help on the tax
side. We're a multidisciplinary practice.
Right. What kinds of business are your clients?
Mostly large companies, mostly operating internationally. And most of what I'm doing is trying to help them solve arguments with the tax authorities, mostly in the UK, HMRC.
What's interesting about you, Heather, is you're a bit of a gamekeeper turned poacher, correct? Because you were working for HMRC.
So I started off training as a chartered accountant, and I then went into industry. I was the group tax director for a FTSE 100 company, and then I had a couple of years with HMRC. So actually, the gamekeepers recruited me to help them catch the poachers.
Right.
And now I've gone back to being an advisor.
Right. OK, well, my next guest is Rolf Rothausen, a partner at RPS Legal. It's a Dutch law firm, and that specialises in corporate structures. And you are a lawyer, Rolf. Just tell us a little about your company.
The law firm that we have in Amsterdam, especially working for companies, entrepreneurs, helping them to optimise their taxes. I'd rather talk about tax optimising instead of tax avoidance, because tax avoidance would imply that you should pay tax, but you don't. And tax optimizing is getting structures right in several countries, jurisdictions, and get it done.
But your clients, are they Dutch companies or are they what you'd call international companies?
Yeah, very diverse. Of course, we have Dutch companies who are internationally active and need structuring tax-wise. Mm-hmm. And we're dealing with a lot of foreign companies too, coming from abroad, being active in the Netherlands, for several reasons, you know, good jurisdiction, the Netherlands, to do business in Western Europe, and we're helping them to have a good tax optimization.
Now, you have said something quite interesting. Netherlands is a good jurisdiction to do this in. And we're going to get to this, but let's just start it straight away. The Netherlands is a good jurisdiction, in a word, because it doesn't tax the royalties you make from intellectual property.
That's correct. There are more reasons why the Netherlands is a very good jurisdiction to do business in, but that's one of the reasons that the intellectual property and royalties are not taxed.
Right. OK, well, my third guest is Anthony Travers, chairman of the Cayman Islands Stock Exchange and senior partner in a law firm there, Travers Thorpe Alberga. Tell us a little about the Cayman Islands, Anthony.
Well, it's a well-recognised offshore financial centre, very often mischaracterised.
As a tax haven?
As a tax haven. The problem being that when you say tax haven, you don't have the slightest idea what you mean.
Don't be defensive, Anthony. Don't be defensive. No one's attacked you yet.
Well, the expression tax haven is very often used in a pejorative manner. And I hope to do something to dispel those mischaracterizations.
The Cayman Islands, just its status, it is a British what?
It, way back, was what we call a colony, but now an overseas territory. So it is internally self-governing, democratically elected local legislature who deal with internal legislation, with the British government under the Constitution responsible for internal security and matters of defence, external affairs.
OK, thank you all. Now, each of you is involved in some different aspect of tax. I'd like the, you know, listeners to know more at the end of this programme about corporate tax than they do at the moment. So let's just start with some basics. The first thing is, when we tax a company, it's profits, not sales, that we're taxing. Go on, Heather, pick that up.
So companies are a fiction. They're there to embody the actions of a group of investors, the shareholders. So you could say, let's not tax companies at all, let's just tax the people that invest them. But we actually tax companies probably for three main reasons. Firstly, we can. It's a convenient way of collecting money. Secondly, as a proxy for taxing the shareholders, and if you think of many companies are global now, if you wanted to try and tax the shareholders, that gets awfully complicated when the shareholders are all over the world and they keep changing very rapidly. And the third reason is that if we didn't tax companies, firstly, there'd be even more of an outcry about what companies are doing. And secondly, you would then drive some very peculiar behaviours. I don't know if you remember, a few years ago, Gordon Brown had a zero rate of corporation tax for the first slice of income. Every hairdresser in the land formed a company because they were going to save a few hundred pounds by doing it. So why wouldn't you? So they're there to collect money because it's convenient and because if you didn't, you'd have even bigger problems.
Right. So now, maybe, Rolf, you can just explain, because you picked up with this word tax optimization. So for people who don't know the difference between optimization, avoidance and evasion, yeah, it's worth us getting that vocabulary right.
Of course, when you talk about tax avoidance, you should always be within the boundaries of the law.
So it's in the law.
Of course. Tax evasion is then you're breaking the law, which is something different, of course.
I think on your point, Evan, the crucial distinction here is that there has been a dramatic change in the last few years, with the result that in terms of the offshore financial centres and a number of onshore, including Switzerland, tax evasion is simply off the table. Yeah. There are now extensive treaty networks which give revenue authorities unlimited power to investigate matters.
I think around this table, none of us condones tax evasion. Mm-hmm. And that's not what we're talking about today. But I think within tax avoidance, there are 50 shades of grey.
I want to know why it gets to be so complicated. So let's just take what one might think of as the simplest example, a company that operates in one country only. And it's a very simple company in that it has some equipment and makes widgets, sells them in that country, and then has to pay tax on the profits. Now, in that case, is it difficult to work out the profit?
Well, in your example, Evan, nothing complicated happens. A company that's doing business in a jurisdiction exclusively will pay tax in accordance with the laws of that jurisdiction.
I think there are still complications. So suppose you're making something more complicated than widgets. Suppose you're building a wind farm. You don't get any tax allowances on the cost of the land to build the wind farm. You do get tax allowances on the equipment that you put on the land, but you don't get tax allowances if that equipment is part of a structure. So think of a wind turbine. The bottom of it is a concrete base, and then you've got the stalk and the turbine at the top. The turbine's clearly machinery. The stalk, probably machinery, and the base at the bottom probably isn't. So you have those sorts of
technical
arguments.
I thought we were taxing the profit of the company, and I thought that meant all we had to do was measure the sales of the company, which is the income, and then subtract the costs of the company, which are all in pounds and pence. What's so difficult?
There are revenue costs, so there are costs of salaries, costs of
stationery. So you subtract those,
But you will also make some capital costs. So you'll incur costs for equipment and machinery, which perhaps lasts for a number of years. And for book purposes, you might write that off over 10 years. For tax purposes, you have to check whether it qualifies for capital allowances. And that's a big area of dispute.
So it's how you allow the costs of capital.
Yes.
So let's now take an international company and let's make it a simple one that's still building widgets. What are the other complications that come from it being international?
Because it's trading internationally or has branches in other countries, for instance. Why should that company, which is maybe original UK-based, just pay taxes in the UK only? And why could that international company not profit from the benefits that there are in different jurisdictions?
In a nutshell, what is the international tax treatment of a company based in the UK that sells in the Netherlands, say? How do we divide up the profits between Netherlands and UK? Go on, Heather.
So starting with your simple example, I'm a UK company and I'm selling my widgets to Rolf in the Netherlands. He's my customer. Mm-hmm. He rings me up or he sends me an email and says, can I have 1,000 widgets? And I say, yes, certainly, and I send them to him. I don't have any tax liability in the Netherlands at that point because I haven't traded in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. I've traded with the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. So I'm just selling to, not trading in.
So you pay now, UK corporation tax on,
my whole
on that profits.
Profit. Now,
right.
Rolf is a really good customer and I decide there might be lots more really good customers. So I send out a saleswoman to the Netherlands and she builds up my trade, but she doesn't have any authority to conclude contracts on my behalf. She has no fixed premises And therefore, all she's doing is generating leads for me. And I'm still making the sale. Right. So I still don't have a fixed place of business there. She does so well that she opens a local shop, and then I've definitely got a Dutch tax liability.
Right.
And then we have to decide how much of the profit is my profit as the manufacturer and how much goes to the Dutch authorities as the sales profit.
Right. So now we've got to divide it between Netherlands and UK. This is where we get to double tax treaties. Mm-hmm. The international system is designed so that you don't end up paying tax on the same bit of profit in the Netherlands and in the UK, correct?
Correct.
Well, that is absolutely the theory.
There's a very important principle that might be worth exploring. When I'm manufacturing the widgets or whatever, I'm a resident of the UK. So the UK is the residence company. If the sales are taking place in the Netherlands, then that might be the source of where that income is. And a lot of tax treaties are dividing up taxing rights between residence and source. And on the whole, active things go where the source is. So if I'm active in the Netherlands, that gets taxed there. Passive things like royalties or ownership of something stick with residence. And that's the big tension. Should the resident state or the source state have the right to tax?
Right. I think this is now getting us to the heart of some of the complex issues around the big international American companies that are producing a lot of intellectual property. OK, so Rolf, we started with the local company. We've moved to an international simple company. So now we get to a company that has got intellectual property. It's not just a machine producing widgets.
No.
It's got patents, it's got design ideas, it's got a brand.
Colors, fonts, whatever, name it. Could be a property of the company and you should pay for it. For IKEA, for instance, when you go to an IKEA, of course, the colors blue and yellow are...
That's intellectual property. We don't know about IKEA's tax affairs, but let's take our widget company, the one that's operating in lots and lots of countries. We want to keep profits down in those countries. So we make, say, the Russian branch pay somebody else for the use of our logo. So the Russian branch doesn't look like it's very profitable because after all the fees it's paid for the logo or technology or whatever. It doesn't make much money, so it doesn't have to pay much tax in Russia. All those royalties the Russian branch is paying, we want them to go to the Netherlands, not to the UK, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And that's because you guys just don't charge any much on those kinds of royalties. You're a good tax place for those royalties.
Yes. Obama called us a tax haven. Dutch government wasn't amused, so they had to...
But you are a tax haven.
Of course we are. Just don't say it out loud, you know. But we are, actually, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, and that's the reason why all this kind of stuff happens.
So have we got here the essence of how companies avoid tax? It's basically, if you're operating in multiple jurisdictions, lots of countries, you create costs in the high tax ones so that those profits look low and all the profits are made in the low tax countries. Is that the essence of it, Heather?
It's not as easy as that. There's a principle called the arm's length principle.
Mm-hmm.
Which underlies all of the double tax treaties and most tax systems. And that says you can only charge a price that is a reasonable price for the use of a name or technology or whatever. And working out whether that's the right price or not is difficult.
But now look, in what way is it not taking the mick?
I think you've got to look at it from the perspective of the board of directors of the companies involved. Their obligations, statutory, common law, are to act in the best interest of their companies. It's not their fault that the double tax treaty networks don't work effectively. The one thing that's absolutely clear is they are in constant communication with the tax authorities in their jurisdictions.
You're putting your finger on how business has outstripped the tax system. So the rules for royalties and intellectual property were written when they were thinking of engineering designs and patents. So if in order to manufacture my widgets, I need to use a particular machine, I might well have to pay a royalty to use that bit of technology to get the right shape widgets. And it's quite reasonable that that's a payment for intellectual property.
Totally.
And you might well want to hold that intellectual property in Switzerland because Switzerland has got some ferocious patent lawyers who will protect my patent for me. And it's not wholly to do with tax. But as business has become more global, intellectual property has got more complicated. And particularly with all the tech firms, the technology and the mathematics underlying search engines and the way that business is done are hugely valuable. And yet it's very difficult to put a number on it and to say how should you value it. So the tax system struggles. What's going on at the moment actually is trying to realign the taxation of intellectual property with the economic substance.
Right. Okay.
I think you also, Evan, need to put your point in context. Global taxation runs at $23 trillion. The concerns you're talking about are really in the order of $100 to $200 billion. No one is saying Google doesn't pay tax.
No,
the big dispute, the thing that's upsetting Meg Hillier on the Public Accounts Committee is where Google pays tax.
Right.
But it's actually a $100 to $200 billion problem, which is, statistically, a half of 1% of the total tax revenues in the world.
But you've actually said something very interesting, Anthony. So we've got a company like Google. It doesn't tax evade. It sticks within the law. If it pays little tax in the UK, that could be because it's been very clever and managed to keep its overall tax bill down. And it could also be that it's paying less in the UK, but that tax is popping up as more tax in the United States, which is the kind of resident company, correct?
Correct.
So you can see what Google's doing as an argument against the global tax system, but you can also see it as a tussle over revenue between one country and another country.
So the question is, firstly, is the tax cake being divided up fairly?
Yeah.
And secondly, is the tax cake as big as it should be?
Yeah, correct.
And I think the greater concern is where income is not paying tax anywhere.
Correct.
Would you agree that if, say, an American company has transferred some of its intellectual property, its technology, to the Bahamas or Bermuda or the Cayman Islands, which does not charge corporation tax, if that is totally legal within the US tax system, that could result in that income not paying any tax anywhere?
No, it wouldn't ever transfer intellectual property to an offshore financial centre
that had no
double tax treaties.
I disagree.
Well, highly unlikely, because what it wants to do is generate royalty income.
Yes.
In other countries and get deductions from
yes.
it. But you need the double tax treaty
True.
Network to do
so
that.
So you used Rolf's Dutch sandwich. So
okay, let's we're getting into the Dutch sandwich, which is one of the most popular and interesting of the big tax avoidance devices that global companies use. Now let's just pause for a moment. Just to remind everyone, you're listening to The Bottom Line. We're talking about multinational companies and the efforts they make to reduce their tax bills with Heather Self of Pinsent Masons, Rolf Rothausen of RPS Legal in Amsterdam, and Anthony Travers of the Cayman Islands Stock Exchange. OK, we're making progress. We've talked about some basic principles. We've talked about the complexities, and we sort of see where the opportunities for some tax avoidance might arise. Let's just talk about some specifics. There's this double Irish and the Dutch sandwich. I mean, Heather, can you explain a little bit of what we're talking about with these very specific devices?
So an American company might hold some intellectual property in, let's say, Bermuda, and it wants to receive royalties on that. So in the UK, I pay a royalty to Rolf's company in the Netherlands. I'm allowed a deduction because it's a genuine royalty. It's for use of intellectual property. Rolf in the Netherlands receives that and pays it on to the tax haven. No tax in the Netherlands because the money broadly goes in and out, and no tax at the end in the tax haven.
Because so there's no corporation tax.
Because there's
at
no
the
corporation
end.
Tax there. Yeah. In theory, the US wants to tax that money eventually. But in practice, so long as you keep it offshore, the US doesn't tax it. And that's why US multinational companies have got somewhere approaching $2 trillion held offshore. They don't want to bring it back, because if they bring it back, they'll have to pay the tax.
Just so people can understand it, let's take this very simple example of what's going on here. So I'm an American company. I'm using the word Apple here, but it's not the real Apple. It's hypothetical Apple. So Apple have intellectual property. They have phones. They sell them in the UK.
The value attributable to the UK is low, because all the UK is doing is selling.
Yeah.
And companies that just sell make a relatively small margin,
right,
because
right.
they're not the people who've got the engineers and the whizzy
We
stuff.
Haven't done anything. We've just bought the iPhones. So the UK Apple is going to send a big cheque and say, look, we need to pay somebody for the intellectual property that we've sold in the UK. So the UK is not going to get a big corporation tax slice out of that. The money is going to go somewhere, and they don't want it to go back to America. So they're going to send it to...
initially to a country with a tax treaty, quite often the Netherlands or Luxembourg.
Right.
So it will typically go through a country with a tax treaty.
So it goes to the Netherlands, But Apple shareholders don't want it in the Netherlands. So what happens then?
It then goes from there to a tax haven company. But the tweak is that that company might be incorporated in Ireland, but tax resident in Bermuda.
Well, no, Heather, it's not a tweak. It's an essential feature.
Yeah.
That the company
this
in question,
is the double Irish.
The double Irish. The both companies in the double Irish have to be Irish companies.
They can't
be a Cayman Island company. The use of the zero tax offshore financial centre is for a different reason. US corporations that hold their assets in offshore jurisdictions like Cayman, like Bermuda, are enabled by US law to defer taxation on the profits. And this is US legislation, not Cayman Island legislation, not Bermudian legislation.
It's the US which is at the heart of a lot of this.
It's the US legislation. It's, again, the legislation in the onshore jurisdiction.
So Apple have made all their money, it goes through Rolf, it goes off to Cayman or somewhere, and it sits there.
Yes.
It can't go back into the US.
Let me stop you. It can't. What the US laws say is this. It does not sit in the offshore jurisdiction. If it did, it would be deemed distributed back to the US. The only way the US corporations can lawfully defer taxation annually is by reinvesting the profits immediately in arm's-length trading with an unrelated party. And those provisions are there for a very specific reason of US tax law, and that was to make US corporations more competitive globally.
And the effect of it is that you have big multinational US-based companies like Apple that have hundreds of billions of pounds sitting in overseas investments.
Yes.
Now, if they want that money to go to their shareholders, what they do, this is the crux of it, is they borrow against it.
Yes.
And then they can give money to their shareholders. Yes. I borrowed the money, I haven't got it, but hey, we've got assets overseas which can...
But eventually it's not sustainable because you end up with so much money offshore that you don't quite know what to do with it. And we must be getting quite close to that point.
Right. So look, now I just want a very specific discussion on tax... Well, I'm calling them tax havens. You call them what you want. Tax havens.
Offshore financial centres is politically correct
these
days.
I know. Just give me an example of a good use of the Cayman Islands, a typical use that is not about tax avoidance.
The best use is hedge fund structuring. I mean, we have anecdotally two-thirds of the world's hedge funds, $2.2 trillion assets under management. And those hedge funds originally came to the Cayman Islands because 30 years ago we designed some very, very specific legislation for hedge funds that attracted the hedge funds.
What are they looking for? Are they looking to wipe out tax, or is it because they want to avoid double tax?
They want to avoid triple tax.
Give us an example of how they might end up with triple tax if they didn't.
Well, here it is. We know 60% of the $2.2 trillion is invested in New York. It will pay taxes in New York on its profits in accordance with whatever US law says should be taxed and deducted at source. Mm-hmm. The net amount will be remitted to the Cayman Island hedge fund.
Yeah.
And when it's distributed by way of dividend or redemption of capital proceeds to the investor, that investor will pay tax in accordance with the laws of his or her jurisdiction.
Right.
So what they're looking for is a structure in a well-regulated jurisdiction with appropriate legislation that doesn't impose a third layer of tax.
But what I don't understand is, why don't you just put the hedge fund in New York? It makes the money in investing in the New York Stock Exchange and then hands the money to the shareholder. What are they getting by sending it to the Cayman Islands in
because between? Because the regulatory framework of the United States, if an investor invests directly in New York, is infinitely more complicated. The UK investor investing in the US is going to have all kinds of personal tax returns and forms to fill in that he isn't going to have to fill in if he invests in the Cayman Islands fund directly.
If you were starting again, just for listeners to understand what might be a better system, wouldn't you have a global corporation tax which said, we're going to take the global profits of these companies and then we're going to divvy it up between nations on a turnover basis?
But that's not fair. I'm making my widgets in the UK and I'm using my really good technology, which I've developed here, and all my sales are being made in the Netherlands because they want to buy my widgets. So why should the Netherlands get all that tax?
OK, that's why it's difficult. Yeah. Let me ask a question of you each about the corporate responsibility, because when I talk to people, I get a sense they expect better of companies than that the companies will engage in the most complicated schemes they can think of to minimise their tax. What do the three of you in your professional lives think of as being the difference between the legal limit and the acceptable limit? Or is there no difference between legal and acceptable?
Let me say, as a lawyer, you learn to get rid of all the emotions, you know? So it's just the facts that are there. And then you can go as far as is possible.
There is a law governing how much tax you pay. And it used to be the well-accepted principle, 1936 case, Westminster, that you always interpreted a tax statute strictly in favour of the taxpayer. Now, there's a shift here. But what are the CEOs of corporations to do? They have legal obligations, as I said earlier, to act in the best interests of the company. If you simply say, pay what's fair, you're really resorting to the rule of the mob. I mean, who says what is fair?
No.
I'm going to disagree with both of you now. I think companies have a choice about how they do transactions. And in the way they do the transaction, that will lead to different tax consequences. If a company chooses to do that transaction in a way which is excessively complicated in order to save more tax, yes, they're entitled to do that. But there are costs that come with that choice. And those costs are the costs of implementing it, which can actually tie up a lot of management time, the potential costs that the tax authority won't agree with you, so you might end up not saving any tax anyway, and the potential reputational cost. And that is one of the costs that I think increasingly companies are taking into account. But the difficulty is that because the whole system is so complex, sometimes even if a company is doing something utterly reasonable, it still looks as if they're dodging. And I think we've got to do more, and companies have got to do more, to try and explain what they've really done.
Let me make a very simple remark about morality. Two companies, competition, same products. One is doing tax optimizing and the other is not. The one who's not, with a high moral standard, will go bankrupt because of that. And all the employees will be without a job. One. Second, all the public who are saying about morality, company A, with the tax optimization, can sell the product for 30% less than the other company. I know where all these people who are talking about morality will buy the products. I know it.
They'll go to the cheaper one because it's got less tax to pay. Yeah. We need to leave it there. Complicated topic. We've covered a lot of ground. Let me thank my guests. Heather Self, tax partner at Pinsent Masons. Rolf Rothausen, partner at the Dutch law firm RPS Legal in Amsterdam. And Anthony Travers, who is chairman of the Cayman Islands Stock Exchange. Do visit our website, bbc.co.uk/bottomline. Fully deductible. You'll find details of how to download the programme there. Otherwise, I'll be back with more guests next week. Thank you for listening. The programme was produced by Sally Abrahams in association with the Open University. And if you enjoyed this edition of The Bottom Line, you might be interested in other BBC Radio programmes like Moneybox, a weekly podcast with the latest news from the world of personal finance.